A Family That Flies Together Sticks Together. Chapter 5. Trigger Warning for Descriptions of Traumatic Brain Injuries and Medical Procedures. "Andy," Niall says. "Andy, what the fuck is going on?" They are not in the stadium's medical bay or even their usual hospital affiliate. Instead, they are at a private institute Niall had almost gotten lost in, sprinting through the hallways in full gear before skidding into the right observation room. Andy has her wand drawn as Niall bursts in, and she doesn't lower it as Niall stares at her, panting. The look on Andy's face makes Niall's words burn in her throat, and when Andy doesn't speak, Niall thinks she might throw up. No. No. The observation window is too wide and bright to hide from. Niall's eyes move past Andy to stare through the glass, and she's terrified to look, but even more afraid of not knowing. The room beyond seems to be a Muggle operating theater, which runs at odds with the familiar figure of Celeste, wand out over Joe's prone form. Niall is painfully glad Celeste is blocking Joe's head from view. She will already have nightmares from the little she's seen. Before she can ask again, the door to the operating theater opens and another Celeste walks in, also in full scrubs. Niall squeezes her eyes shut before looking again. There are still two of them. In front of her, Andy shakes her head. "That's Celine," she says, voice short. "Celeste's twin. Muggle liaison doctor. Neurosurgeon." "Neurosurgeon," Niall repeats, watching Celeste and Celine move around the table, an oddly in sync sight. "I didn't know we used neurosurgeons." "We don't," Andy says, and then sighs, lowering her wand. "Where's Nikki?" she asks. "Why isn't he with you?" Niall inhales, breath still and steady, and tries to clear her head. Her heart is hammering in her ears. "Nikki attacked Keen," she says, and Andy curses. "He drew his wand and then punched him and then..." She pauses, mouth struggling with the words. "He went wandless. I don't know if he meant to, but Keen couldn't even touch him. I couldn't even... before..." She stops, grimacing. Her skin is still prickling. Andy drops into one of the chairs and drags her hair back from her face. "Did they sun him?" she asks, and Niall nods. Andy scoffs. "Okay, that won't last long. Considering it's Joe, they should still let him." They hear footsteps running, and then the door swings open and Niall stifles a gasp as Nikki strides in. Like her, he's still in full gear. He's also covered in blood and bruises, a gruesome sight in the sterile room. Two game officials flank him, wands out. Neither look very confident about it. "Officers, give us a moment," Andy says, standing. "Coach, I'm not sure if you're aware," one of them starts. "I'm aware," Andy says and raises her wand. "I'll stun him if I have to. Just give us a minute." Both officials make a hasty exit and Andy sheaths her wand. "You should keep that out," Nikki says, and Niall starts at his voice, harsh and hoarse and not like Nikki at all. "And then... tell me." Andy steps up to him, blocking his view of the observation window. "Are you ready to hear it?" she asks, voice quiet but equally harsh. "Because we're in the middle of an operation, so are you ready?" Anger twists Nikki's face, ugly and hard, but Andy stands her ground, unwavering. After a moment, Nikki closes his eyes and inhales, excruciatingly slow. "All right," he says, cutting through the rising tension. "Tell me." "Joe was hit in the throat and the head," Andy says, pointing at the exact points of contact. "The throat was lucky. We can reform it. With the head..." Andy pauses for the first time, and fear stabs through Niall like an actual dagger. She sees Nikki feel it too, as he takes a jerky step forward. "Andromache," he says, and Andy holds up a hand. "He's alive," she says. "His skull could be reformed, but..." the brain. Dread is slowly dripping down Niall's spine, so cold it is paralyzing. She watches Nikki focus in on Andy, all of them barely breathing, unable to look away. "You know the work I've been doing off-pitch?" Andy says, and Nikki nods, the smallest of movements. Niall is in the dark on this one, and she feels infantile in the face of that unknown history. Nikki is only a few years older than her, but he's been part of Quidditch for far longer, and Andy is synonymous with the game itself. "You know the risks of magic on the brain, even if no one will admit it. So Celeste and I," Andy takes a breath, "we believe it's best to heal everything external with magic, but internally, neurologically, we go muggle." Nikki makes a terrible wordless noise of horror and tries to push past Andy. Andy cuts him off, arm out. Nikki jerks back, eyes wide, and they both stare at each other. "What the fuck does that mean?" Nikki says, and his voice is brittle. Niall knows his ingrained stance on muggle medicine. Even if she's managed to moderate him over the years, this is inarguably the absolute worst time to bring up that debate. "It means that no magic touches the brain," Andy says. "Everything else will be easier with magic, including recovery, but the brain itself, we can't risk it, Nikki." There is something terrible in her voice, something so painful Niall can't fathom it. If it wasn't Andy, Niall would almost say her expression is pleading. "You said it wasn't approved," Nikki says, and his voice is clear, but the edges of it are trembling. "You said the research wasn't ready." He's staring at Andy like he's praying to be wrong. Niall understands this moment to her core. They regularly do whatever Andy orders without hesitation, almost without question. Right now, Nikki is on the precipice of that almost. Andy opens her mouth, and Niall has the overwhelming urge to claw Andy's voice back before she says, quiet and devastating, "It's not, officially speaking." For one horrible moment, Niall thinks Nikki might attack Andy. If it were anyone else, he might have. Anyone else would also have backed away by now. But Andy only keeps his gaze still and unblinking. When it seems like Nikki cannot speak, Andy continues. "But it's far enough that I believe it's our best bet, Nikki. To save him. To keep him." Nikki squeezes his eyes shut and Niall can see his chest rising rapidly. The air around him is buzzing, low but tangible. And she can feel Nikki warring with it. Can see Andy's hand resting over her wand. After a long moment, Nikki opens his eyes again and moves around Andy. She doesn't stop him this time. The room grows very still as they watch Nikki take in the operating theater. It must look terrifying, foreign, and cold, and filled with muggle tech. Celeste and Celine stand opposite each other, two identical figures holding very different instruments. Celeste is projecting a brain scan above Joe's head, a three-dimensional model outlined in gold with red glowing through it as they work. She moves around the table, and Joe's face comes into view. Niall looks away. Nikki chokes, and when he does speak, his voice is raw from the sheer effort of keeping it steady. "Why have they shaped his head?" he asks. Andy moves to stand beside him, and her hand clenches over his on the edge of the window. "They have to relieve pressure on the brain," she says, like she's reciting a prayer. "That doesn't answer my question," Nikki says. And then Celine reaches for her tray, and Nikki inhales sharply. "What is that?" "It's a common procedure for this kind of injury," Andy says. And even her voice isn't steady anymore. "Listen, Nikki. It's standard, I swear. They drill holes into the skull." Nikki jerks back from the window just in time for Niall to see Celine cut into Joe's head in one swift motion. Nausea rises through her as Celine secures Joe's scalp open, so gaping and wrong she can't comprehend what she's seeing. She has to close her eyes then, but she still hears it, the high whine of machinery, the gasp that wrenches itself out of Nikki's throat. When Niall opens her eyes again, Andy has her arms around Nikki like she's holding him together. She's cupping the back of his head with one hand, pressing his face against her neck so he doesn't look through at Joe, at what is being done to him. The gash on his cheek has reopened, bleeding anew, but neither of them seem to notice.
"Andromache," Nikki says, and his voice is shaking now, cracking. "Why? Why this?"
Andy draws back, still holding Nikki's face. His blood stains her hands.
"Niccolo," she says, and there is grief in Andy's voice that is too ancient and too painful to comprehend. "Niccolo, you know why."
And Nikki shudders, like he's forcing the answer into his bones. When he nods, his eyes are shining. And when he speaks, the only word he says is a novel.
"Quinn."
There is one piece of footage that every Quidditch player and spectator has seen, quiet, hushed, and best never mentioned again. It is from the last game Andy ever plays in the league, the last game of Andromache and Quinn, the Scythian and the Pit Viper. There is little argument that they were the greatest beaters of their generation and indeed of the entire pre-modern era. In the footage, the camera catches Andy as she arcs into a beautiful shot, so hard the crack of it blows out the audio. Of course, it's before the game was reformed post-millennium. Andy has barely any padding on, her bat larger and non-standardized. The bludger is bigger than Niall has ever seen, its solidity and weight evident even through the footage. It's aimed at the opposing seeker, who swerves out of the way, just in time for it to cave directly into the side of Quinn's face. It's too bad of a hit to be kept in public archive. The record cuts to the ground, many wizards blocking the camera's view. Andy is on her knees beside them. No commentator can find their words. The footage jumps forward. By this time, the Mediwizards are clearing, some lying back on the grass from sheer exhaustion. Andy's back is to the camera, leaning over the stretcher. Quinn's hand comes into view, gripping Andy's shoulder as she sits up, agonizingly slow. They have reset her face, her skull, even cleared most of the blood off her face. For a second, the entire stadium exhales. And then, Quinn begins to scream. Often the audio cuts here because the sound is too terrible to carry. Raw and wild and never ending, on and on and on as Quinn claws at her own head, like she's trying to tear her scalp off. Andy screams with her and turns on the Mediwizards as Quinn lashes out with an agony too great to witness and yet unable to be seen. Every time it seems to ebb, a new wave builds seconds later, over and over again. They sedate her. But even unconscious, whatever is wrong keeps going. Quinn's body is convulsing as they transport her off the pitch. It is the last time Quinn is ever seen again. "They fucked up," Andy says. Healers had arrived to take Nikki away, and he had let them, flanked by officials in dripping blood. The look on his face before he leaves will stay with Niall forever. But they all knew he had to go. Niall still can't look at what Celeste and Celine are doing, so she sits beside Andy instead, hands clasped in front of her. Andy knows she's praying, but for once says nothing about it. When Niall finishes and looks across at her, Andy's staring through the observation window. Niall can see every line cutting into her face. "I fucked up." "It wasn't your fault," Niall says, and Andy shakes her head, a tired, worn movement. "I fucked up and then they did," she says, and Niall doesn't argue with her again. This is why the gear regulations changed.
protocol for pitch ops, all of it. They did what we always do, reset, 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 and that magic works well for everything else. But for the brain? Andy shakes her head again. Her voice is so stiff, Niall thinks Andy would shatter if she touched her. When it works, we forget. And when it fails, it's an anomaly. And when it came to us, Andy's fists clench. They treated her like we deserved it. Niall swallows the anger in her throat and waits for Andy to breathe to continue. Everything healed, physically, but something did not. We can't test her anymore, but it's like the moment of impact is just looping. The nerves misfiring, maybe, just over and over and over. Andy cuts off, but her voice is completely dry, like she's been wrung out for so long she can't even form tears. I spent 10 years trying to figure it out, she says. 10 years. And nothing. Andy, you came back after that, Niall says, because every modern player knows this part of the story. You came back, you made sure proper reform happened, you kept helping, and now you've established a new medical procedure, for fuck's sake. The corner of Andy's mouth twists up. And can I guarantee it'll work? Or it won't be worse than if I just let the Mediwizards heal him, she says. And the weight of her question settles over them both. No. But I couldn't risk it. Not again. Niall takes a breath because she doesn't want to ask, but she needs to know. Andy glances at her and answers before Niall is forced to form the words. She's a permanent inpatient, she says. She can stabilize with obliviation and a controlled environment, but it's like PTSD. The loop is still there. Andy stands like the words hurt too much to sit with and walks slowly to the observation window. Niall keeps her eyes on Andy's outline, the way her shoulders bow as she says, I'm the biggest trigger. Even reminders of me would set her off for days. Weeks. Out of the corner of her eye, Niall sees Celine swap instruments. Andy watches unblinking and unflinching, like she has to, like it's penance. When she finally speaks again, her voice is thick. Niall, I will never see her again. I can only live with it, knowing that she's still alive, but not her, not anymore. And how much pain she's in. Andy turns just a little. Her face is completely devoid of color. I'm not letting that happen to Joe and Nikki, she says. Whatever it takes, that's why I did this. Niall stands and joins Andy next to the window. She doesn't look in, just presses her shoulder against Andy's. I understand, Niall says and feels Andy exhale. Whatever it takes. The last thing Joe remembers is the snitch just under his fingers. Pain, greater than he has ever felt. Screaming, but he doesn't think it's him because he can't speak, blood in his mouth. Andy. There's only flashes after that. Hospital, lights, great sways of nothingness, voices. Nikki. Where is Nikki? Someone's hand on his shoulder waking him. The room is almost dark, so it takes him a moment to recognize Andy leaning over him. She smiles when he gets his eyes fully open, and he tries to smile back but can't quite manage it. His entire head feels numb and yet still hurts. Hey there, champ, she says, voice low. Just waking you every few hours, you know how it is. Joe does. He tries to nod, but can't manage that either. He winces, goes to speak. He can't. A horrible gasp grips his throat instead, and when he tries to touch his neck, his arms don't respond. He His heart jolts as he suddenly thinks, oh, fuck, I'm paralyzed. I'm fully paralyzed. Hey, hey, Andy says and runs a hand down his arm. He can feel that, at least. It's okay, you're just on a lot of potions right now, yeah? Your head got fucked, but it's stable right now. Your voice box is reforming, give it time. Try not to move too much. Joe breathes out through his nose, trying to keep it slow. He manages to stretch his hand out, and Andy grips it, calloused fingers comfortingly rough over his. He squeezes twice. Nikki's fine, Andy says, but her voice isn't right. He's just recovering right now. No, Joe, he's fine. He's not injured. He will be here as soon as he can, okay? Joe, calm down. Slow breaths, come on. She runs through the checks, and Joe can feel sleep dragging him back down, but he doesn't want to. He doesn't want to go again without... He gets woken again, and again, and again. Each time, it's not Nikki, it's not Nikki, it's not Nikki. They are still at the hospital 10 hours later. Nikki refuses to leave the room the healers had put him in long after they'd fixed his face and fractured hands. Refuses is a stretch. He has simply stopped responding. The only time he had moved was when Niall had forcibly started removing his pads. He'd gotten silently out of his gear and showered, changed into the clothes she'd brought him, drank some water but refused to eat, and gone back to sitting on the edge of the bed. He does not speak, and he does not look at her. Niall doesn't leave, though, just takes the seat behind him and waits. Each time Andy comes by, Nikki listens to her updates and nods. Nothing more. No one states the obvious and tells Nikki to go to Joe. She can almost touch the pain emanating off him, the fear, even after the healers have tested and cleared him at 4 hours, 7 hours, midnight. He sits as far as he can from them and watches his hands. Niall has almost dozed off when there's a commotion in the hallway outside, voices angry and stricken. Ma'am, you can't... Yes, we can. We're his family. Ma'am, I'm sorry, but you're obviously not. Excuse me? He's our brother-in-law. Nikki looks up. Every moment is slow and stiff, but his eyes refocus as the voices get louder. A moment later, the door bangs open and the Alkazani sisters stride in. Zara in front, Amira closing the door firmly on the officials outside. Aisha nods at Niall, but Zara beelines for Nikki. He half raises an arm as if to ward her off, but she ignores it and tackles him into a hug, nearly sending them both back on the bed. Zara, no, Nikki says. And it's the first words he said in hours, voice hoarse. Nikki, Zara says, and when she pulls back, she has tears in her eyes. Nikki, you crazy bastard. Thank you. Zara, Aisha says, and her voice is hard, but her expression mirrors her sister's. Nikki is leaning as far away from Zara as possible, his hands splayed away from her, but Zara grips his shoulders and stares into his face. Are you okay? She asks. Did Keen manage to hurt you, or did you just fucking destroy him? That's enough, Aisha says. And Zara huffs and sits down next to Nikki as Aisha pulls up the closest chair. Before Nikki can move away, she reaches out and grips his hands. He flinches backwards, but she hangs on, face grim. Nikki, don't let it psych you out, or it'll get worse, she says, and turns Nikki's hands over in hers. See? They're fine. Nikki stares down. His skin is very pale against hers. I passed Slater on the way in, she says, and Nikki nods, minute. At this point, it's over to legal and the league. Right now, you need to focus on keeping your head on straight, and you need to focus on being there for my brother. Can you do that for me? Her voice is calm but commanding, and Nikki looks up. Niall would be impressed if she wasn't so fucking exhausted. Our parents are with him right now, Aisha says. You should see him before he goes back to sleep.
Nikki says, and a shudder runs through his whole body. Aisha gasps like she's been stung, and Nikki jolts up, backing away. Aisha, no. Are you okay?
I'm fine, Aisha says, showing him her hands. Just a little static.
It's not, Nikki says, and puts his head in his hands.
I can't see him, he says, voice cracking. I can't.
His back hits the wall and he slides down it, face pressing against his knees as he begins to cry. If the silence had been bad, this is much, much worse. The hours of fear and adrenaline flooding over, culminated and concentrated. Aisha tries to go to him and hits the same barrier Niall had faced on the pitch, invisible and shocking. The lights of the room begin to flicker.
Get the healers, Aisha says, and Niall's already at the door.
Get the healers before the officials come, quickly now. It takes 4 days for Joe to see Nikki again. By then, Joe is so antsy, they're lucky he's either unconscious or too weak to move. Otherwise, he would have tried to escape, and Aisha would have killed him for real. Instead, he blinks awake in the late afternoon and finds Nikki asleep next to him, twisted uncomfortably in the too small chair. Joe's heart jumps as he realizes it's not a dream, that Nikki is actually there, within reach. He looks gaunt and exhausted, a jagged scar taking up most of his left cheek. He's still the best thing Joe has woken up to.
So, Joe says. His voice has just started coming back and he clears his throat. I heard you bought a Brit for me.
Nikki jolts up, half rising out of his chair before he's fully conscious. When he realizes Joe is awake, his eyes widen as green as the first time Joe had seen them, and just as worried. Joe's words register a moment later, and a laugh rises out of Nikki's throat, shaky and trembling. It sounds like the first time Nikki has exhaled in days.
Andy showed me the footage, Joe says, smiling at him.
Every stretch of his skin twinges.
Shit, Nikki. You just had to outdo me, didn't you?
Nikki chokes out another laugh and sits back down. He sways towards Joe like he can't help it, but his hands remain by his side, fingers clenching around the edge of his seat.
Nikki, Joe says, and reaches out a hand. Nikki, it's okay.
Nikki shakes his head.
You've seen, he starts, and then his throat seems to close before he can carry on.
He looks down before speaking again.
We have to be careful, especially during immediate recovery.
Yes, my immediate recovery, Joe says, and right now the patient needs his love to hold his hand. Jump to it, champ. That's enough to get Nikki to look up, incredulity coloring his face. Joe wiggles his eyebrows, even though it hurts his face, and the corners of Nikki's mouth lift just a little. Joe remembers the first time he'd seen Nikki smile, his real smile, and how he'd immediately thought, well, shit, we've got to see that again. No matter how bad things have gotten, Joe has always prided himself on being able to draw one out of Nikki. Slowly, Nikki takes Joe's hand and Joe squeezes triumphant. After a moment, Nikki seems to accept that nothing will explode and squeezes back. His eyes run over Joe's face like he's trying to catalog it, and Joe waits, watching him back.
Joe, Nikki says finally, and all traces of his smile are gone. Joe, I'm so sorry. Oh, Dio, I'm sorry.
His hand is hot under Joe's, skin almost tingling.
I should have been here earlier. Nikki says, I should have stopped this. I should have.
He cuts off, jaw working, and takes a rigid breath in. The grief radiating off him is so strong, Joe can't find his words, and Nikki stares at him, face wretched.
I'm sorry, he says, like he doesn't even know what for anymore. How are you feeling? Like ass, as Niall would say, Joe replies, trying to smile. But much better than before. How about you, amore mio? Nicky shakes his head, pulling back, but at least he doesn't let go. I'm fine, he says, and Joe gives him a pointed look. Nicky sighs. Things are about to get really fucked, Joe finishes for him, but doesn't say it. He knows that beyond the haven of his hospital room, absolute chaos must have already descended on the League, the Guard, and most importantly on Nicky, at the epicenter of it all. Joe wants to hold him so badly his arms ache with it, but he can barely get out of bed right now. He wants to run outside and tell everyone else to fuck off, to stand beside Nicky as the inevitable comes for them. His own inability makes him grind his teeth, which only aggravates the headache that now sits constant under his skull. Everything aggravates that headache. Joe knows that being alive right now is a miracle. He knows what Andy has done, knows why, knows the possible alternatives. He should be grateful to have the dexterity and speech and movement he has now, only 5 days later. But not being able to reach Nicky when he's so close and yet so lost in his own mind makes Joe feel weaker than he'd imagined possible. It's such an ugly feeling that he can taste it, acrid and cloying, and he grimaces, wincing. Nicky is leaning over him in a second. What's wrong? He asks. And Joe shakes his head. Up close, the scar on Nicky's cheek looks angry and raw, and Joe raises his other hand to Nicky's face. Nicky flinches back. Joe freezes, hand caught in the air before he's forced to drop it, too weak to keep his arm up. Nicky stares at him, horror and guilt all over his face, and Joe thinks this must be a bad dream. But no. He's in too much pain to be asleep. Scusa, Nicky says, like he has nothing left to say. Mi dispiace. Joe opens his mouth to reply, and his stomach lurches as he expects words to be there, and nothing is. He swallows past the fear of that, tight in his chest now, and tries again. Tesoro mio, he says, and Nicky looks at him, face creasing. It's okay. I'm okay. We'll get through this. I love you. I love you. Nicky starts, but then there's a knock on the door and the healers are coming in for Joe's afternoon checkup. Nicky sits back like he's been caught doing something wrong, and his hand slips from Joe's. Joe doesn't have the strength to stop him. Joe, Niall says. Stop trying to eavesdrop. You know they've soundproofed the room. Joe makes a face at her, which immediately makes him wince and resumes their endless circuit of the garden. Nicky, Caitlin, and Slater are visible in the study, bent over the table. They're surrounded by stacks of accumulating files, their faces lit by the glow of a tabletop projection, replaying the incident on loop. As Joe watches, Slater pauses it with his wand and says something that makes Caitlin throw up her hands. He gestures back, equally exasperated. Nicky says nothing. It's been a common scene over the last week. Niall's hand is gentle around Joe's elbow as she turns him away from the house. You good? She asks, and then raises an eyebrow at him when he nods. Like, actually good, or actually sore and lying about it so I don't make you go back to bed? Joe laughs, remembering to keep it small. I was on bed rest for 7 whole days, he says, emphasizing the horror with a shudder. Let me enjoy my escape from hospital, Niall. Nicky will have my head if you're being dumb about it, Niall says, but keeps walking with him. Their steps feel like slow motion. Joe knows that Nicky would be with him if he could be, quietly keeping pace. But from the moment Joe has been discharged, Nikki has been occupied for great swathes of the day. Having your entire life fall apart can do that to your schedule. The league restricts Nikki from all games and practices effective immediately while they deliberate on a formal punishment. Their house is now headquarters for a relentless roster of guard personnel and healers, and there's no escaping it because reporters are crawling over any place Nikki might go to. It feels like house arrest, and claustrophobia has Joe itching to stay out of bed. Nikki is trying to sit through hours of strategy and press prep without disturbing him, since he can't stand too much noise, but it's worse, knowing Nikki is being grilled without knowing what's being said. "Any news updates worth hearing about?" Joe asks, and Niall sighs, blowing air through her cheeks. "Honestly," she says, and they both grimace. Everybody wants an angle, and he's been playing for so long, there's just endless content to go through. She gestures as they walk. On one hand, he's always been so professional that there's not much dirt to dig up, but also so private that all people know him for is being a beater, and that's a lot of footage of him hitting people. Joe grits his teeth. He knows exactly what that makes people say, what people can assume of Nikki without ever knowing him off pitch. He remembers Nikki after he'd knocked Joe out, shaken and trembling. Nikki, talking excitedly about obscure stats during their first dinner together. Nikki, getting out of bed to check on Chris during all-nighters. Nikki, coaching their little league team in Joe's neighborhood over summer. Joe's heart aches in his chest, exacerbated by his inability to fix things, to solve them. "Bet you're all being hounded for quotes," Joe says. And Niall shrugs in a nonchalant way that can only mean yes. "We've been told not to say too much until the league makes their call," she says. "But yeah, the character trial is bullshit." She pauses. "It's also bigger than Quidditch, you know? The old debate over wandless magic right now is..." She clicks her tongue. "You don't want to be at a bar when an Italian and a Brit start that conversation, trust me," she laughs. "But it's a tired, hollow sound." Joe's already asked after her, is trying to give her as much support as he can, even as they leave her without alternatives. He knows she won't accept his apologies or Nikki's guilt, but still. Before he can broach the topic again, Niall's phone chimes. "Med's time," she says, and Joe grumbles. He's nauseous so often now that keeping anything down is a real bitch. Niall puts a hand around his back to mock push him towards the house, and he slings an arm around her shoulders and squeezes. When she leans her head against him, just for a moment, he presses a kiss against her hair. Joe can't stand the smell of his evening potions before they're mixed, so he escapes down the hallway while Niall preps. He pauses outside the study just close enough to hear. "I think that's the most we can do," Slater is saying tiredly. "The fact that Keen used much heavier spells on you, and that your wandless magic was more defensive and didn't cause injury or good bets. The rest is..." His voice grows quieter and Joe strains to hear. "Hang on," Caitlin says. Her voice is clear but hoarse, and Joe's heart squeezes. She shouldn't be managing this level of disaster. But in another grand addition to Nikki's guilt fest, Ada has just gone on maternity leave. Despite Nikki's protestations, Ada is dialing in when she can with a newborn in tow, while Caitlin spearheads the case full-time. Caitlin has been in charge of Joe's portfolio, and by proxy Nikki's, for so long now that she seems to be taking it very personally. Chris has shown up a few times for the express purpose of making her take a break. "Nikki, off the record," Caitlin says. "Just tell me, what were you intending here? And did you mean to go wandless?" There's a long pause, and Joe knows they're rewatching the footage again as if they hadn't already memorized every angle of the event. When Nikki speaks, his voice is almost unrecognizable. "I wanted to hurt him," he says, "and I didn't mean to go wandless." The silence that follows tells Joe that Nikki has just said the worst answers to both questions. "Firstly," Caitlin says, and her tone makes Joe's heart jump, never say that in public. I wasn't planning to, Nikki says. And Slater lets out a noise that might have been a laugh if it weren't for the context. All right, Caitlin says. I just wanted to know, for me. And we can discuss that as a separate issue, but right now I'm pretty sure Joe is eavesdropping outside. How the hell did you know? Joe asks, pushing the door open. Don't I always? Caitlin says, stretching. Shit, is that the time? Slater shuts off the projection, looking relieved, and Nikki stands. He smiles at Joe, small but present, and for a moment everything is fine. It's only when Nikki passes by him to go help Niall that Joe feels a jolt of dissonance, the realization that he's inherently expecting something after it doesn't happen, a brief hand on his arm or hip or something. It's always been so natural how they touch each other, never overt when other people are present, but always there. Joe doesn't realize how integral it is to his understanding of Nikki, of them, until Nikki stops doing it. They haven't even had time to discuss it. Joe isn't sure he can without feeling selfish. Because despite his own clusterfuck, Nikki is a model caregiver. There are so many uncertainties around Joe's novel surgery that the healers have Nikki on watch for everything and overseeing so many regimens that Joe has lost count. Nikki does it all without break or complaint and is one of the few people who can do so without Joe going mad. Because Nikki understands what it's like for them to be injured, the reflexive disgust at being an invalid, the crippling helplessness that tastes bitterly of shame. Even if Nikki's never been injured so badly, he knows the visceral desire, no, necessity, to be able to play Quidditch again. Nobody will broach the topic just yet. It's not a good sign. Joe knows Nikki lies awake with him at night and feels the overwhelming terror that is unavoidable this early on. They both taste it when Joe struggles to walk steadily or hold complex spells, head constantly aching and dizzy. But whenever Joe looks at Nikki, his face is set and steady, even when Joe's fear and nausea manifest in irritability. Anger rings in Joe's ears every time he thinks about what this injury could cost him. Rage rises so rapidly in his chest he can barely breathe. It happens so uncontrollably now that Joe feels alien in his own brain, in a body that already doesn't feel like his own. Maybe that's why Nikki has stopped touching him. Joe has to grit his teeth every time that insidious little thought crops up, because no. He knows it's not about him per se, sees how careful Nikki is now around everyone who passes through their home. When Joe asks, Nikki will answer, but there's such a quiet, cavernous pain in his voice that Joe doesn't push. When Joe wakes at night, every night now, he finds Nikki lying inches away from him, tense and rigid. He still flinches away from Joe if caught by surprise, and every time sits like a brand across Joe's fingers. So he tries to swallow down his own bewilderment and frustration and fear, tries to be a good patient, tries to wait, tries to ignore the dread that hangs over them both, heavy and smothering and inescapable. It'll get better. It has to. It gets worse. The league officially suspends Niccolò Genovese for the full remainder of the season. Considering the decision is announced by late September, Nikki will lose an entire regular season from his career and any playoff games the guard may make. Additionally, he is banned from all team practices and public gatherings and from attending any EQL games and related events. Nikki is at Andy's when the public announcement is made, and he stays there for a very long time. Long enough that Joe goes to bed. When he wakes at 2 a.m., the bed is cold and empty. It takes a groggy moment for Joe to remember what's happened, and then he's wide awake, trying to calm the roiling anger and fear he feels at Nikki's suspension. There are so many pain points to the suspension that Joe can barely comprehend it. Kneecapping Nikki's career at its height. The consequences of losing an entire season of training. Cutting Nikki off from the league he has called family since 17. After a while, it is clear that Joe is not falling back asleep. He refuses to keep painkillers by the bed, so he gropes around for his dressing gown before heading out. He keeps the lights off and grips the banister, still unsteady, down the stairs. The kitchen lights are on. Joe squints as he rounds the corner and Nikki looks up from the counter. He still has his jacket on, a bottle of wine open next to him. "Joe," he says, and his voice is almost unrecognizable. "Sorry, did I wake you?" "No," Joe says, eyes running over Nikki's face. He is very pale and very still, eyes sunken in his face. Joe cannot think what to say. The silence between them is unbearable, too heavy to carry but too acute to face. Joe moves slowly around the counter and Nikki watches him like he's cornered. "Nicolo," Joe says, and puts his arms around Nikki's neck, drawing him in. "It's all right." Nikki's head shakes against Joe's shoulder, but he doesn't say anything. He is rigid all over. But as Joe holds him, Nikki's hands come up to grip at Joe's back. Joe kisses the top of his head, unable to stop the tears that sting his eyes, running into Nikki's hair. A whole season. A whole goddamn season ripped out of Nikki's life when it is Nikki's life, their lives, both adrift now. "I'm sorry," Joe says very quietly. He cradles the back of Nikki's head and squeezes as Nikki makes a choked noise against his neck. "I'm sorry, Nicolo." When Nikki finally begins to cry, it's like a broken dam trying to keep back a flood. Joe can feel Nikki desperately holding himself in, even as sobs rack his entire body, rendering him breathless, even as he barely makes a sound. Nikki clutches at Joe like he is an anchor against his grief, even though Joe feels like anything but. He thought he'd felt helpless before, bedridden and immobile. It doesn't compare to this, hearing Nikki's choked-off cries and being unable to stop them, holding on to him so tightly and still having him shake apart. They stay there for a long time, locked together. There's nothing else they can do. Joe will never know how they lived through October. On one hand, Joe starts walking steady again. His headaches are less frequent and slightly less intense. He knows it's a miracle, aided, just as Andy had said, by magical medicine post-surgery. Regardless, it's hard to stay grateful when he has spent his life at the peak of wizarding athleticism and can feel the sheer amount of strength he's lost with every step. To just return to a healthy baseline is not the point. The point is whether he can play Quidditch again. And Celeste's answer remains so uncertain that uneasiness crawls under Joe's scalp, keeping him awake. He is tested so frequently that he feels like a lab rat, trapped on the same wheel and never seeing the progress he wants. He tries to distract himself. He draws, he reads, works on design suggestions for his clothing co-line. He hangs out with Booker a lot, which is one of the few things keeping him sane. If there's one thing Booker understands, it's a long and bumpy recovery, where every day is a new battle in the same damn trench as last week. Booker listens to Joe bitch about it with endless patience and ribs him like nothing has changed. It is calming to see Booker so healthy, to laugh with him again, like they're back in the locker room together. There's just one thing. Booker's new job. He had indeed become a sports analyst. With his background, broadcasting networks had been vying for him since he'd reappeared, and he'd been able to negotiate a good deal. Part of that deal was not being forced on camera before he was ready. He'd eased into the job during preseason, and then, well, it's just another thing to add to Nikki's guilt trip list. "So," Joe says one afternoon when Nikki is out, "how's being on the dark side?" Booker rolls his eyes from where he's shaping his sourdough. Apparently he is that guy now, and Joe is an unwitting complicit. "I'm not actually press," he says, and Joe waves a hand. "Semantics," he said. "Your departments are cousins, close enough to be tainted." "They're mostly lovely," Booker says, and Joe makes a gagging noise. "Don't act like you don't have press friends, Joe." "It's the principle of the matter," Joe says, and then looks at Booker's smile turning down. "Seriously, though, how bad is it? I can still avoid most of it, but Nikki..." He sighs. "It sounds horrific, even when he's downplaying it." Booker grimaces. "I won't lie," he says. "It's unprecedented." "Ugh, gross," Joe says, lobbing a tea towel at him. "You sound like one of them." "Mmm," Booker says, absentmindedly catching the towel and folding it neatly in his hands. "But it really is, especially with how controversial the call is. There's an endless amount to dissect there." "They're asking you to talk," Joe says. The lines deepen around Booker's mouth as he says, "Yeah, for sure. They're nice about it since I'm new and all, but, you know, it's where the viewership is. And I'm being hounded for interviews by everyone else anyway. Better to do it there on my terms." He gives Joe a small smile. "Could do some good, to be honest. Set the record straight instead of just yelling from my couch." Joe reaches out and grips Booker's arm. "You know Nikki would never ask," he says, and Booker nods, cutting him off. "Trust me, I know," he says. "So when it happens, remind him it's my choice and he can stop taking the blame for literally everything." "You tell him that," Joe mutters, and Booker raises an eyebrow at him. "Not to be obtuse," he says, "but you two all good? Can't be easy cooped up here with both of you going through hell." Joe leans back a little. It's not an unexpected question, but it's different coming from Booker, who knows both of them so well. Nikki and Booker had reconnected after his retirement like they'd never drifted apart, and it fascinates Joe to remember that Booker had adopted Nikki as a rookie so long ago now. The history there makes Booker's eyes particularly piercing as he waits for Joe's answer. He's not much older than Joe, but that makes it worse to know how much Booker has been through and lost. Joe looks at him and finds himself unable to lie. "I'm not sure," he says, and then wants to shove his words back down his own throat because he has always been sure about Nikki. And he is. He knows he loves Nikki more than he can express, and he knows Nikki feels the same, has proved it to Joe 1,000 times over, even when he doesn't need to. They love each other so much it's tearing them apart, unable to witness the other suffer so much and be so powerless about it. Booker's face softens. "What are you not sure about?" he asks. Joe shakes his head and goes to run a hand through his hair, forgetting that it's still shorter than expected. "He's trying so hard," he says. "And he's perfect with me, and that's..." Joe stops, searching for words that don't immediately contradict. "That's not what I want. That's not what he needs," Joe says, and is overwhelmingly grateful when Booker nods. "What do you want?" Booker asks carefully, and Joe sighs, fatigue gnawing at him far sooner than it should. "I just want him to be free," he says, "of the ban, the attention, being stuck here, looking after me." His voice wavers and he clenches his hands. "I hate that I make him so worried." "Hey," Booker says, and his hands are warm around Joe's shoulders. His face is so understanding, Joe can barely look at him. "That's the price you pay," Booker says, "to have this life and to love as deeply as you do." He smiles, like he's remembering something too sweet and too sad all at once. "But that's a choice. And he's chosen to be here, Joe, with you, every day. You want to try to make Nikki do something he doesn't want to? Really?" Joe smiles a little, conceding the point, and then laughs as Booker pulls him into a back-slapping hug. They're both covered in flour by the time Nikki gets home. In the end, Joe catches Booker on broadcast the way he catches most of his news now, overhearing it in the middle of the night. They're in such bad sleeping patterns by mid-October that Joe will often wake without Nikki by his side. Joe is fitful, and Nikki wakes too easily. Joe tends to wake when Nikki's not asleep, so it's hard to argue against sleeping apart, aside from the fact that Joe hates it. Sometimes, when he can't bear it anymore, he'll get up in the dark and find Nikki in one of the guest rooms, also wide awake. Sometimes he'll be trying to read or analyzing gameplay to continue helping the team. Joe knows it hurts him to only be able to watch and to watch the guards struggle under their sudden loss. Joe also knows Nikki does it at night to hide it from him, so he doesn't have to see Quidditch at all. When it's particularly bad, he'll find Nikki watching the news. Joe is glad he'd been medically banned from broadcast for the first month. He's not sure how much more anger he can harbor before his head explodes, which is a more literal feeling than he'd like to admit. But Nikki hasn't been able to hide at all. He's lived in inquiries and meetings and press conferences for the last month, and even as he retreats from the public eye post-ban, the press fervor continues. Joe knows everybody's trying to filter Nikki's intake, but they're not around to stop him at 3 a.m. This time Nikki's in the living room, lights off, broadcast glaringly bright in the dark. Joe stops in the hallway just listening. It's a bunch of pundits from Booker's network earlier that afternoon, which means Nikki had recorded it to torture himself with now. "I mean, they say he only meant to block Keane when he went wandless," one is saying, and Joe grits his teeth. "Not this again." "But who knows what Genovese was really intending, or how far he would have gone if they hadn't stunned him. He says he was in control of it despite no notable training, but does that really seem like someone who's in control? He looks practically unhinged, for God's sake." "Oh, come on," a second voice says. "There's no point speculating like that. He's given his statement, and it matches what happened to Keane, which thankfully did not cause injury. We've all seen the fight 1,000 times. "I mean, looking ahead," a third pundit says, "I'm more interested to see if the ICWQC allows Genovese to play in the World Cup this January." "Yes, great question," the second pundit says. "They're a different governing body to the EQL, but it would be a bad look to rule differently. Historically speaking, they've tended to follow league decisions." The third pundit laughs. "God, I'd hate to be in Italy if that's what's announced, especially after such a close loss 4 years ago. In terms of Worlds, Genovese doesn't have that many opportunities left, and we know Team Italy were likely to appoint him captain this time, too. The country will riot." "Frankly," Pundit One says, "I find Italy's hero worship of Genovese quite disturbing. He's obviously not the role model they make him out to be, and yet they'll blindly support him." "Hey now," the second pundit says, tone sharpening. "Let's not forget that Genovese has many supporters, and not just from his home country. Players have drawn wands before and not received such a harsh punishment. His suspension is controversial for a reason." "He did a lot more than draw," Pundit One retorts. "And so did Atkinson, 8 years ago," Pundit Two snaps back. "But I suppose it's different when you're British, huh?" "All right," Pundit Three says quickly as Pundit One sputters. "Let's save that for when we speak with the EQL tomorrow." "As if they'll ever admit to bias," Pundit Two scoffs, just as Pundit One says. "Either way, my point stands. I'll bet a lot of Genovese's supporters are simply fans that want to see him play. We cannot just support him because he plays well. He obviously has issues." "Issues," a new voice says, and Joe straightens as he recognizes Booker. "And what exactly do you mean by that?" Everyone falls silent for a moment. Booker's voice is calm and clear and cuts through the rising agitation like a knife. Joe quietly rounds the corner. Nikki's on the couch, back to Joe. Booker looks a little pale under the studio lights, but his shoulders are relaxed and open, camera catching his good side. "Anger," Pundit One says, raising a finger. "The inability to separate his personal and professional life. A lack of control over his magic." "Right," Booker says, head tilting. And is that coming from a long history of these issues? Or is it actually so out of character that it makes a good story? When none of the other speakers seem to have a quick answer, Booker continues. I understand the concern around glorifying players. Regarding the points you just raised, it would be a serious concern if Nicky had a history of fouls and fights and excess anger. But he doesn't. In fact, before this, I clearly remember that the media's biggest complaint was that he's so professional it makes him very boring. Anything newsworthy came from his play, which, yes, included violence because it's Quidditch and he's a beater. If you wish to critique the game, that's fine, but that's a separate conversation. Booker pauses, but the other speakers seem as transfixed as Joe is. As for his personal life, I mean, it took a season for people to confirm he and Joe were even together, and that was precisely because of the personal-professional divide. Even after they went public, it's been pretty uneventful, and that's despite being with Joe Alcazani, who, as we all know, loves a camera. The other pundits laugh because, well, Joe will let Booker have that one. I'm not excusing what Nicky did, Booker says, but I am looking at it from the context it was in, rather than a context that makes it a scandal. I dare say most of us would have had an extreme reaction at seeing our loved ones almost killed. Booker's voice remains amiable, but his last words make Joe shiver. Nicky has not moved an inch since Joe had rounded the corner. With all due respect, Pundit One says, because of course they do. You're particularly biased by your close friendship with Genovese, correct? Or do you feel like you've missed something, if this is so out of character for him? Maybe you don't know him as well as you thought. Booker stares. In public, he has always been an affable and humorous figure, rarely becoming serious, let alone upset. Right now, however, he looks like he's back in front of the goal hoops, focused, steady, and dangerous. It's a subtle shift. Joe prepares himself. Fascinating, Booker says, and while his voice is still perfectly polite, there's a chill in it that makes the other pundits go still. So I'm both too biased by actually knowing him for over a decade, and also incorrect because I didn't predict his reaction to this specific event. I simply mean, Pundit One says, but Booker shakes his head and says, I know what you mean. But if everyone is making sweeping character assessments like we're all judges, then I'll give mine, as the only person at this table who knows him. He sits forward, and they cut to a close-up. Booker's eyes are as clear as ice. I have known Nicky since he first started in the league. I didn't just play with him. He lived with me. In fact, he lived with myself, my wife, and my sons. Everybody's eyes widen. Booker never talks about his family. From the moment he'd returned from his year off, it has been basically contractual to not ask him about it. Joe can't imagine that's changed. So this is Booker choosing to say this. Everybody wants to know, what is Niccolò Genovese really like? Are the endless exposés and op-eds and interviews we've gotten since he was a child inaccurate? And I'll tell you that Nicky does not have the wherewithal to act. What you see is what you get. He's been under international scrutiny from such a young age to suddenly infer that his desire for privacy is to hide something sinister is an illogical reach to me. So many players and personnel have come out on record in support of him, people he's worked with, played with, and against. Booker, Pundit 2 says, almost hesitant, a lot of footage has been dug up over the last month, including of Genovese's first year, where he really had quite the temper on pitch. Did this concern you at all, considering he was living with you and your family? No more so than with any other teenager under extraordinary pressure, Booker says, voice steady. Every player in his position has to learn how to manage that, and I'm proud to say that he did. Probably too well, since he got called boring for the next decade. He still shouldn't be considered a role model, Pundit One says, stubborn. Especially when he has so many young fans and players that look up to him. Children shouldn't see that their hero can make mistakes, get punished for it, and then grow from it, Booker asks. His mouth is almost smiling, but his eyes are unfathomable. Or are we saying this one moment cancels out everything else he's ever done, even as he's paying for it? Well, is it just one moment? Pundit One says, and Joe has to manually unclench his jaw. Or has this been a risk since he lived with you? Booker takes a slow breath in. Pundit One almost looks like they're about to keep talking, but the expression on Booker's face stops them. I had to trust Nicky in my home from the day he arrived, Booker says, voice soft. My sons were 5 and 6 years old. My wife was pregnant with our third. None of them had magic. Joe can see the tense line of Booker's jaw almost too clear on camera. So I think it's fair to say that no one took the issue more seriously than I did. He shifts. Many things about Nicky have not changed since then. He's stubborn. He's awkward. He's hardworking to a fault. He's terrifyingly good at his job, but never by fouls. That's all public knowledge. Booker's chest rises, and he closes his eyes for a brief second. In private, he became a brother to my sons. Even when he was stressed and alone and could barely speak French, even when they were goading him constantly, he looked after them when he was never asked to. And with Corinne, Booker stops and clears his throat. His eyes are bright. Nicky helped deliver our son, for God's sake, when I couldn't be there. I have seen him at his worst times, and he has been there for mine. So from knowing him that well and trusting him with that much, no, I don't think it's been a risk since then. And before we carry on with the public character trial that's so popular at the moment, maybe consider a little logic, a little dignity, maybe some compassion. That's what Nicky would do anyway. The broadcast switches off and the lounge is plunged into darkness. Joe hears his own breathing, more labored than it should be from simply standing there. Slowly, Nicky turns his head. Well, Joe says, voice too loud in the dark, guess we owe him a gift basket. Nicky doesn't laugh. Joe steps forward, but before he reaches the couch, Nicky stands, taking 2 steps to the center of the living room. He faces Joe, but he's looking down, moonlight not bright enough to illuminate his features. That was good, Joe says, because the silence is too heavy after what they've just watched. Really shut down that first dickhead. They were right, Nicky says. His voice is wretched. Nicky! Joe says, exasperation rising because they've been here. They've been through this. Booker wasn't the only one supporting you there, even if the others are meant to be balanced or whatever. And you know Booker's right. You have so much support from so many people. Booker's statement is just another in the long list. He shouldn't have done that, Nicky says, his voice thick. And Joe is so tired of seeing Nicky hurting like this. Standing straight, even as his edges start to crack. They made him. He chose to, Joe says. He was always going to speak for you, and this was the best platform for that. He lied, Nicky says, and Joe stops. Nicky runs a hand through his hair, pulling at it. I wasn't. There was one time. I wasn't good with. He cuts himself off and takes a deep, painful breath. The pundit was right, he says, voice low. I lied. I wasn't in control. I wasn't thinking. I just wanted. He stops again. It's too dark to see if there are tears on his cheeks. Nicky, Joe says, and he doesn't want to sound like he's pleading, but it goddamn feels like it. Please come back to bed. Let's think about this in the morning, okay? Nicky sways, and Joe's heart lifts before Nicky says very quietly, You go. I'll take a guest room. Nicky still isn't looking at him. 6 steps away. It may as well be 6 continents. Joe goes. In the last week of October, Nicky wakes to find a note on his bedside table. To Zorro, it says in Joe's beautiful handwriting, Gone for a test flight. Celeste had to move it earlier. Wish me luck. Be back for lunch. Love you, X. Nikki's heart jolts as he reads the words test flight. Joe had been looking forward to it for a while now to really see how he was back on a broom. Every healer has been tempering his expectations after being grounded for so long, but Joe's recovery has been better than projected. They're all cautiously optimistic. The healers always remark on Nikki's perfect adherence to Joe's potion schedule and neurophysical exercises, which they all know Joe wouldn't adhere to half as well without him, and Joe always grins at him and winks. In those moments, they feel like a team again. Nikki misses those moments. His fingers brush over the "love you, X" in Joe's looping script, and his chest constricts. He knows how frustrated Joe is with himself and with his injury, but also with Nikki as he struggles to keep his head up. No, that's not fair. Joe is endlessly patient and empathetic and always trying to make Nikki laugh, always there when Nikki cries. He knows Joe worries about him, even when Nikki's not the one who nearly died. He's just the one who fucked up so badly they can barely leave the house. The one who has abandoned Niall as captain, forced Chris into a role he was not ready for, and left the team struggling in the air and harassed on the ground. He knows front office has been working overtime since the incident. Knows all of Joe's friends and family have been accosted by press and public alike. Either in support or in opposition, it doesn't matter. They shouldn't have to bear it. At least, Nikki thinks, he didn't have many people to warn on his side. No one who wasn't already involved with Quidditch in some way and already understood the politics of it. He'd left his brother a message the day of, because Jeanvie's PR team deserved a little warning at least. He'd gotten no reply. He hadn't been expecting one per se, but still, he'd thought. Well, he thought wrong. Nikki goes through his new morning routine. Breakfast, checking in on the team, secretly checking the news, home gym for several hours, shower. He's making lunch when he hears the front door slam. Joe? He asks, cautious. There's no answer. But a moment later, Joe comes stalking through the kitchen, not even glancing at Nikki as he passes. He beelines for the sliding doors, out onto their back deck and down into the garden. Nikki watches the stiff line of his back and follows. Joe has stopped in the middle of the grass, facing the trees. His fists are clenched at his sides, and his shoulders are hunched in that way Nikki knows means he's in pain, but won't say. Joe, Nikki says, several steps behind him. What happened?
What do you think?
Joe says, voice sharp. But at least he always responds. Doesn't go silent like Nikki does. He's grateful for that.
They said it might take longer, he says, and Joe whirls to face him. His eyes are blazing. They said I should at least be able to fly, he says, voice rising. Nothing fancy, nothing high, just be up there for a while, just fly.
His mouth twists, expression ugly with grief and fear and self-loathing, plain to see. Nikki feels the same emotions grip him. His own flight time has plummeted with his suspension. And that already makes him feel like he's been hacked off at the knees. Joe has been flying since before he could run properly. To not be able to fly, even casually, is a horror they never wanted to contemplate. Nikki feels his palms itch and takes several deep breaths, counting them. Joe watches him, his expression still twisted.
How long were you up for? Nikki asks. Not long enough, Joe says, which means he was flying at least, to some extent. Do you go too high too quickly?
Nikki asks, trying to figure it out. Joe's expression darkens.
For God's sake, Nikki, he says, and Nikki stares at him. Can you just... Yes, I went up because I felt good. I felt great. I was flying again, even if I was flying like a child. And then my goddamn head...
Joe raises a hand and presses it against his forehead, grimacing.
Okay, Nikki says, feeling his own heartbeat in his temples. Okay, and did they set another date for a test flight? Or do we wait?
Nikki, Joe says, and his voice is caught between supplication and frustration. Nikki feels the familiar tug in his fingertips, wanting so badly to help, but being too afraid to act. Can't you just be angry with me? Rage with me? Something. Something other than this fucking calmness I know you're pretending to have. Joe's chest is rising and falling rapidly, and Nikki feels the same turmoil under his skin. He clenches his hands. I have to be calm, he says, looking away from Joe's eyes, the opened wound of his expression. I have to, or else. I'm sorry. It's not, Joe says, and gestures like he wants to shake Nikki but can't bridge the gap between them. I just want you. Joe's been lost for words more times in the last 2 months than in all the years Nikki's known him. It never fails to make his blood run cold.
What do you want? Nikki asks, voice very small to his own ears.
What do you want me to do? Joe stares at him. For the first time, Nikki can't read his expression. I have to go, Joe says, and strides past Nikki back towards the house. I'm sorry, Nikki, but I have to. Nikki follows several steps behind as Joe moves through the kitchen and past the hallway.
For a moment, Nikki remembers them, embracing in the foyer when Nikki had first told Joe he was coming to the guard.
A lifetime ago, moving in the opposite direction.
Fear grips Nikki's throat as Joe throws open the front door and walks out, as he realizes what Joe is about to do.
Joe, he says, voice rising. Joe, you can't operate that far with your head injury. Fucking watch me, Joe says, and vanishes. Booker answers Andy's door just in time for Joe to throw up all over his feet.
Wow, Booker says, annoyingly chill. I assume that's payback for whenever I did that to you?
Sure, Joe says, still doubled over. That's what it is.
Either that or you were trying to make a quick exit and apparated too far for your head, Andy says.
Joe looks up to glare at her, but it's an undignified angle. She cleans up the mess he's made and pulls him inside.
All right, dumbass, she says, manhandling him to the couch. Booker brings him water and a wry smile. Test flight?
Yeah, Joe says. Not good.
Which isn't great, but not unexpected, yeah? Andy says, sitting beside him. But still sucks.
Yeah, he says, and leans back against the couch, closing his eyes. His headache's back, of course.
I get that, but...
Nikki. Andy and Booker both hum, and he cracks one eye open to glare at them as they share one of their looks.
Shut the fuck up, he says, and Booker laughs.
Lips are zipped, he says, and flops down on the recliner opposite them. Though I'll bet on a measly 10 minutes.
15, Andy says, and Joe flips them both off. The fear and frustration bites at him whenever he moves, but he knows it will pass, or at least recede. He will fly again. He will. Properly, too. He will never stop believing that because he can't. But he needs to rage it out of his system, needs to lean into the turmoil before he can let it go, and he wants to do that with Nikki, who would understand him perfectly if he wasn't so intent on being mature, wrapped inside his own nightmares. Joe keeps his eyes closed, and Andy and Booker talk softly around him, Andy's hand smoothing down his arm. 15 minutes later, exactly, there's a knock on the front door.
Oh, for fuck's sake, Booker says, getting up. This is going to be gross.
Andy grips Joe's shoulder as Booker gets the door.
You good? She asks, a voice soft.
You know you're welcome here any time. Maybe without the vomiting, though.
Joe puts his hand over hers.
Thanks, boss, he says, and she smiles at him. Booker's only halfway through telling Nikki about Joe's arrival before Nikki's at the living room door, eyes wide.
Dios santo, he says, turning to smack Booker on the arm.
What was that for? Booker asks, pouting.
He should be lying down with more than water, Nikki says, hands on his hips.
Andy is trying not to laugh as Nikki glares at her.
Booker, fine, but really, Andromache?
I'm fine, Nikki, Joe says. And the world rights itself a little when Nikki drops down next to him and takes Joe's face in his hands. His hands are gentle. Callus is ghosting over Joe's skin. He feels Andy leave the couch and draw Booker into the kitchen, but he's too busy refamiliarizing himself with the green of Nikki's eyes. "I'm sorry," they both say at the same time. Joe laughs and Nikki's lips quirk at the edges. "I'm sorry about your test flight," Nikki says, and Joe grimaces. "I'm sorry I was so... I know what you mean. I just wanted to keep calm, or I'm no use to anyone."
"That's not true," Joe says, bringing his own hands up to Nikki's face. His skin is soft beneath his stubble. "You know that's not true, Niccolo."
"It's true to me," Nikki says, which Joe doesn't know how to answer.
Instead, he leans in and presses his forehead to Nikki's.
They both close their eyes and exhale together. Joe's headache recedes slightly, like Nikki's fingers against his temple are drawing the ache out.
He knows they need to talk, that the frustration from earlier will come back if they don't, uglier each time.
"Nikki," he says quietly, and Nikki shivers. "I need you to tell me what's going on. For real. You're telling me things, but there's more. I know there is."
Nikki sighs, eyes still closed. Joe rubs a hand over his neck and then his shoulder, and Nikki sags against him like a string has been cut.
"I know," he says. "There's just... I don't know. I don't know how."
It's so honest that Joe has to press a kiss to Nikki's hair, and Nikki's hand fists in Joe's shirt.
"Let's go home," Joe says. "And we can figure it out. Okay?"
"Okay," Nikki says, looking up at him. He is still the most beautiful thing Joe has ever seen.
"Let's go home."
Figuring things out gets waylaid by a visit from Joe's parents. Nikki feels the same pressure each time before they arrive.
They'd gotten along well during summer, but that had been a holiday, and not this.
Nikki is sure they can see right through him, and it makes him feel like a fraud when things aren't going perfectly.
"Take your time," Joe had said, stopping Nikki in the middle of his deep cleaning. "Talk to me when you can, okay? Just, please, I'm here."
"I will," Nikki says, even as his mind spins. "I promise." When Mariam and Ibrahim arrive, Nikki tries to make himself sparse. He loves seeing Joe with his parents because they seem to get along so well. Not like friends per se, but as equals without anyone being cowed by anyone else's position. But he's also aware it's a family thing and doesn't want to intrude. There's only so much hiding he can do if the Alkizanis are in the open plan lounge, so he goes into the garden despite the November chill and tries to figure out how he'll talk to Joe. He's going in circles one afternoon when he hears the back door slide open and turns to find Ibrahim walking towards him, Nikki's coat over his arm.
"Thought you looked cold," he says.
And Nikki mumbles his thanks in his still poor Arabic and takes it. Ibrahim stands next to him and surveys the garden. Nikki is immediately self-conscious. Season aside, he isn't a huge gardener, and their backyard is nothing like the Alkazanis. Ibrahim asks after him, and Nikki answers. He hears Joe's voice saying, "There's more, I know there is," and feels like he's lying through his teeth. He gets along with Ibrahim and knows they would get along better if he could just relax, but him being Joe's father inherently makes Nikki's spine snap to attention, and he's hyper-aware of every word he says, every bit of behavior Ibrahim might not like.
"Have your family been over?" Ibrahim asks, and his voice is calm, like he's inquiring about the weather.
When Nikki looks at him, though, his face is warm and open. Nikki feels the trained answer rise on his tongue, but then Ibrahim tilts his head and waits. Nikki sees Joe for a moment, and where he must get his patience from whenever Nikki struggles with his words.
"They," he says, and then concedes. "We haven't spoken in a long time," he says, "and they won't after this."
He feels more than sees Ibrahim acknowledge his words and all it implies. Nikki looks down at the grass and focuses on each individual blade he can see. Ibrahim clasps his hands behind his back and says, "Well, Mariam and I will just have to stand in for them then."
Nicky looks at him sharply and then regrets it. The movement jolts him, and he feels his heart jump in his chest. Ibrahim puts a hand on Nicky's shoulder. Niccolo, he says, and Nicky forces himself to look Ibrahim in the eyes. I do not pretend to understand what you are going through or how you're feeling. But allow me to say, Niccolo, you are a good man. Nicky does not trust himself to move or speak or breathe. He looks into the face of Yusuf's father, and the quiet confidence he finds there makes him feel young enough to cry. He looks at Ibrahim and asks, fumblingly, How do you know? It's a question Nicky hasn't been able to stop asking himself. The minute he asks it out loud, he wants to claw the words back. He can't live without an answer, but also doesn't know if he can live with what the answer may be. Ibrahim smiles, eyes creasing, and says, No one who loves my son like you do could be anything but a good man. Nicky inhales, almost choking on it, and Ibrahim grips his shoulder like he knows it's the only thing anchoring Nicky in that moment. Nicky, he says, we have watched you be in love with Yusuf since the beginning. We have seen you care for him and all your close friends. I've seen you with my daughters. Are you perfect? No. But you are a good man. Never doubt that. Nicky bows his head because he can't bear it. The tenderness in Ibrahim's face, the honesty. He wants to say, No, you don't understand if you'd done what I did without control, without remorse. But Ibrahim is wiser than Nicky will ever feel, and his words settle in Nicky's chest, warm and steady. They stay like that, as the sun sets quietly behind them, and Nicky closes his eyes against it, just breathing. Ibrahim stays with him until he's able to go back inside. The day after his parents leave, Joe is getting ready for bed when Nicky knocks on their bedroom door and looks in, face uncertain. Joe pulls the t-shirt he sleeps in over his head. He's pretty sure it's one of Nicky's old ones. Yes? He asks, bemused. Can I? Nicky asks, gesturing. And Joe's heart clenches when he realizes Nicky's asking if he can sleep in their room. They'd done so when Joe's parents had been there, but now they're gone. Nicky must be wondering if they're returning to October sleeping arrangements. Please, Joe says and pulls back the covers. Nicky comes to the bed, but doesn't lie down. Instead, he sits on the edge and takes a deep breath. Ah. Joe gets into his side and waits. I didn't mean to keep anything from you, Nicky says back to Joe. But I don't think I even knew what was wrong until recently. Or how to say it, when so much was going on. I can understand that, Joe says. What did you figure out? There's a long pause. Something's wrong with me, Nicky says flatly. Joe pauses. How do you mean? He asks, cautious. I could have killed someone, Nicky says. And his words are like his first exhale in 2 months, rushed and ragged. Without control, without thought, but I feel like I could have. I was so angry, Joe. He's staring down at his hands when he adds, quiet but clear, I don't regret it like I should. The words settle between them, unretractable. Nicky's head is bowed, the back of his neck bared, like he is either praying or waiting for something to strike him. Something shifts between them. An understanding Joe could feel in his bones, clicking into place like a key in a lock. He breathes out slow and steady and moves to sit next to Nicky. Nicky hunches over, elbows braced on his knees, before continuing. So I don't regret something a normal person would, that a good person should. And then the magic. A shudder runs through Nicky, and Joe can feel the effort each word takes heavy in Nicky's mouth. I had to say I was in control of it, because I couldn't say I wasn't. But that's a lie. It's a lie that people will find out, because after... Nicky stretches out his hands, fingers straining. You know, when we're younger, unable yet to control our magic. He curls his fingers back into fists. It feels like that, but so much worse. And after what I did, I can feel it now, all the time, like a fever. He turns his head slightly, still not looking at Joe. I want to peel back my own skin just to get rid of it, he says. And Joe shivers. But the more frustrated I get, the worse it is. If I don't keep it in check all the time, it feels like I'll... His words catch and his hands shake with how tightly they're fisted. I might hurt you, he says finally. More than you already are, Joe completes when Nicky cuts himself off. They both inhale at the same time, quick and unsteady. I might hurt you, Nicky repeats. And I would rather die than risk that. From anyone else, it would be melodramatic. From Nicky, it is only the truth. Joe has always loved his honesty. Niccolo, Joe says, and Nicky curls in on himself like Joe's voice is a blow. Niccolo. When Nicky still doesn't turn, Joe stands before dropping to his knees so Nicky has no choice but to look at him. His eyes are dry and clear, but distant. He's retreating somewhere, and Joe can't take much more of it. He puts his hands around Nicky's face and holds on when Nicky tries to pull away. Amore mio, Joe says. Why didn't you tell me how bad it was? Nicky's eyes dart away from Joe's face. I couldn't, he says. Not when you're... I couldn't. I'm sorry. You want me to stop telling you how I am? Joe asks, and Nicky's eyes finally focus on his. Because I know you are suffering. No, Nicky says immediately, and then realizes what Joe's saying. Yusuf, it's not the same. Yes, it fucking is, Joe says, and his fingers tighten around Nicky's face. Nicky, do you remember what I said to you before we were together, when you had those nightmares? Nicky stares at him, and Joe knows he remembers, but he says it again anyway. You're my best friend, Niccolo. I'm always going to be here to listen to you, okay? Even if it's about me. Especially if it's about me. He leans closer, even as his knees protest. Niccolo, don't you know how much I love you? Nicky makes a wounded noise in his throat, eyes closing. When he opens them again, they're shining with tears. But he's here. He's really here in front of Joe, and Joe has missed him so much. You don't think I understand, Joe says, low and fierce. You don't think I would have done the same if it had been you? Nicky blinks and the tears fall right into Joe's hands. Joe wipes them away and Nicky's fingers come up to circle his wrists. I don't know if I'd regret doing it either, Joe says, hushed between them. But a bad person wouldn't be worried about that at all, and it's killing you, Nicky. And we can figure out your magic, no matter what you've had to say publicly. We can. Nicky takes a shaky breath in. I'm scared, he whispers. Joe has never heard Nicky say those words, and never wants to again. So am I, Joe says, and Nicky's fingers tighten against him. But I know that I can be scared with you, and get better with you, and face whatever's next with you, no matter what it is. As long as it's with you, Nicky finishes. And Joe nods. He knows they're both thinking of when they first kissed, when Nicky had said those words while Joe knelt in front of him, just as he does now. It feels like a millennium ago, but as clear as yesterday, both so much younger, and already so in love. Nicky inhales and runs his hands down Joe's arms. Goosebumps rise under his fingers, but they're reflexive, not magical, not harmful. Nicky lifts his hands, staring at them for a moment before cradling them around Joe's face. He is trembling. I'm sorry, he says. I was afraid you wouldn't... anymore.
if you knew all this.
Never, Joe says. Niccolo, I will love you to the end of this life and to the end of whatever's next. And even after then, I will love you.
Nikki makes a choked noise and finally, presses his response against Joe's lips. There's such an ache behind how softly Nikki touches him that Joe presses closer, searching. Nikki shudders, and then he's pulling Joe up, lying back to pull Joe on top of him. They slop back together from one breath to the next, fingers rediscovering the familiar grooves. Joe presses their bodies together, starving for it, and Nikki groans, fingers flexing against Joe's back.
Careful, careful, he says, like it's a mantra to himself.
And Joe kisses down his throat and says,
this isn't the same thing.
You don't know that, Nikki says, even as he arches under Joe. You don't
trust me,
Joe says, pulling back to look at Nikki, focused and sure.
Even if you won't trust yourself, trust me. You will never hurt me. Any part of you. You never would.
He kisses Nikki then, hard and biting this time, and Nikki pushes up to meet him, just as desperate. Joe feels Nikki's fingers dig into his back, and there's a shock to them, a heat that's perhaps too high, but it doesn't hurt him. He realizes distantly that there's always been a current between them when they do this, ranging from a low hum to sparks across his skin. He'd assumed that was just how he felt about Nikki, so intense and so alive. And it is. It always has been. But it's more overt now, how the air vibrates as Nikki pulls Joe's shirt off him and maps out each rib with his lips, how it intensifies when Joe does the same to him. They don't do much more than kiss and rediscover each other, each touch a silent, hello, I'm here, I've missed you. Joe has to lie back down after a while, a slight headache at the base of his skull. Nikki gets him water without looking guilty and kisses him softly after. When he gets back into bed and turns onto his side, Joe curves around him as they've done for years now, and Nikki tangles their fingers together.
Stay with me, Joe says, and he means, like this, like how we are meant to be.
Nikki raises their joined hands and kisses Joe's palm, sealing the promise as he replies,
always.
In December, the ICWQC bends to the EQL and bans Nikki from playing in the World Cup. There are no words, at least in English, to adequately capture the public outcry when the rosters are released. The EQL and ICWQC headquarters receive so much hate mail, they have to shut down their public channels for a while. And the fierce debate between Nikki's supporters and critics reignites. In contrast, the Guards front office receives so much fan mail that Caitlin comes over just to complain. Nikki apologizes as she dumps bagfuls of it on their dining table. But Joe catches him smiling, abashed, as he helps sort through it. Throughout December, every member of Team Italy and much of the crew come visit Nikki. It causes quite a stir as each one is recognized at the portkey terminal, mainly because they all arrive in Team Italy merch and all with Genovese emblazoned on the back instead of their own surnames. Nikki is quietly elated by each guest, and Joe watches him reclaim his place within something larger than himself, something that adores and reveres him, with people who have known him personally since he was a child. Joe is gossiping with Caldara's wife, their 2-year-old pulling at his beard, when he realizes this is his version of meeting Nikki's extended family, the one that has actually been worthy of that title. The whole team calls him Capitano, even Caldara, who has actually been appointed captain in Nikki's place. Joe has always liked Caldara. He's an extraordinary beater himself, in the same cohort as Nikki. It would have been easy for him to resent Nikki, but Caldara has always seemed more concerned by how Nikki's greater success has affected him. We owe him, really, Caldara had told Joe during one of his prior visits. No one else had to deal with the same attention. He's the face. He bears that for us. Now Joe watches Nikki and Caldara talk in the garden.
gesticulating enough to keep themselves warm. Team Italy come like they're on a pilgrimage, and Nikki talks to them for hours, prepared with play-by-play reviews and detailed tips.
"Thank God he's had you,"
Eliza says, squeezing Joe's hand. He looks at her surprised, and the reflexive response of no, he's stuck here because of me, rises in the back of his throat. She smiles at him, and he swallows the thought back down. "We've been very lucky," he says instead, "because it's true, despite everything. It still fucking sucks, but it's true." When Caldara comes back in, he joins them at the table and places a sizable parcel in front of Joe. "A gift," he says, smiling. "From Italy."
"Oh, wow," Joe says and glances at Nikki, who's hovering by the kitchen counter.
He smiles at Joe and gestures for him to unwrap it. Inside is a beautiful wooden box. Fazioli is engraved in one corner, and Joe runs his fingers over the logo before lifting the lid. It's a helmet, but not like any Quidditch helmet Joe has seen before, uncomfortable and uncommon as they are. This one is sleek and narrow, jet black with the guard's logo across the sides. It feels too light for how firm it is, which contrasts with the plush inner cushioning.
"It's a prototype," Caldara says, leaning forwards. "Started a while ago, actually, but little interest or funding until now."
Joe glances at Nikki, who shrugs, trying to look nonchalant.
"Especially designed for flying after head injuries like yours," Caldara says. "With all the regulations around gear standardization, you almost have to go a little muggle with it. We had some of Italy's best wizards on this, figuring out how to achieve the most protection without violating the EQL's rules."
He pulls a face at mentioning the league, and Joe laughs, turning the helmet over in his hands.
"But you, more than most, fly like a madman."
"That's not a compliment, Joe," Nikki says at Joe's expression, and Caldara laughs.
"It kind of is," he says, and Joe preens.
"So this also stabilizes your head for flight, which is one of the biggest issues, yes? Post-injury helmets do that now, but the designs are outdated. This one's state-of-the-art. Healer approved."
"I," Joe says wonderingly, still staring.
He is flying again, in agonizingly incremental steps, and hated every helmet they'd put on him. This one, though, this feels different.
"This must have taken a lot of work," he says, looking around at them all.
"Ah, it's the Genovese effect," Caldara says, and Nikki rolls his eyes. "It moves mountains in Italy."
"It must do," Joe says. He can't help but feel hopeful, which he tries to tamp down.
"I'm still testing my flying."
Of course," Caldara says.
"Whenever you're ready. The team is on standby to tailor it as you improve."
When they're gone, Joe wraps his arms around Nikki and peppers his neck with kisses. Nikki laughs and turns to kiss him properly. It still thrills Joe. Nikki turning towards him, warm and open.
"You've been sneaking around behind my back, huh?" Joe says, mock accusatory. "I had no idea."
"How will you ever forgive me?"
Nikki replies, matching his tone, before his eyes grow serious.
"Do you like it?"
"I can't wait to try it," Joe says. "And it looks very cool."
Nikki smiles, relieved.
Joe can feel the lecture brewing in Nikki's mind, ready to discuss every tiny detail of the design. Joe kisses him again, to distract him, and says,
"Thank you, Nikki. You do so much for me. I can barely keep up."
"I'd do anything for you," Nikki says. And there's only one appropriate response to that. It's a beautiful afternoon. After 4 volatile months, Joe's recovery seems to become more linear in January. It coincides nicely with the league going quiet for Worlds. They're able to have the pitch to themselves for hours, and it feels like coming home, despite missing the team. When they first get back in the air together again, they kiss for a long time, and it's just as glorious as when they'd done it in front of a full stadium. Under Nikki's watchful eye, Joe regains his flight legs. Before anything else, he needs to fly again.
and he needs to fly like Joe Alcazani. In this regard, his new gear is a fucking miracle. Nobody wants to wear a helmet, but this one is so tailored to Joe, he prefers to have it on. It seals his head in somehow, making him feel steady and balanced while remaining breathable in feather light. By the end of January, Joe is able to do his signature triple corkscrew again without feeling sick, and Nikki's laugh rings in his ears as he does a victory lap for an imaginary audience, arms above his head. Whenever Joe's on his mandated breaks, Nikki compulsively runs through his manual flight checks. The league had made Chris hand over Nikki's broom for inspection after the incident, and while it had made sense, it had felt like gasoline on an open wound. Fazioli had argued bitterly for sending the original broom maker to oversee its stripping down and been summarily denied. Even months later, Nikki is still twitchy about it and recalibrates every chance he gets. Joe's not complaining. He's forgotten the thrill of watching Nikki fly, performing basic routines like he's on a highlight reel. Nikki flies like it's a dance, calm and focused but fiercely joyful. He breathes easier out on the pitch, and Joe feels as if the world is clicking back into place. With Nikki beside him, his baby steps back into flight feel less infuriating and more like rediscovery. They get time to show each other old tricks and new techniques, and Joe has never been more grateful for every twist and turn and dive. It's a throwback to how they'd been when Nikki had first joined the guard, constantly crossing the line between banter and flirting, happier than they'd ever hoped to be. "Last to the hoops! Cook's dinner!" Nikki shouts, which is a dirty move since he's already accelerating. Joe curses and pelts after him. Nikki glances back, smile caught in the sun, and Joe thinks, please, please just let me have this for a little longer. In April, Joe comes home to find Nikki and Aisha having a blazing row in the kitchen. Well, Aisha is blazing. Nikki is Nikki. Joe's been out all afternoon with Niall, indulging in retail therapy. The guard had missed playoffs this season, and Joe could make a lovely bonfire with all the bullshit op-eds questioning Niall's leadership. She'll be leaving for an extended holiday in Chicago soon, which Joe is grateful for. It's been quite the season for everybody. She deserves the break. For him, April holds its own challenges. "Honestly, he's barely been cleared," Aisha is saying when Joe quietly closes the front door behind him. "I've never trusted sports healers." "We've had independent healers involved throughout the entire process, Aisha," Nikki says. His voice is placid, but Joe can tell they've been talking for a while. Nikki's no doubt discovering the double-edged sword of having sisters, or at least being adopted by the Alcazani ones. Joe stops in the hallway. He's been on the receiving end of this conversation too often already. Maybe Nikki will have a better response to it. "It's still bullshit," Aisha says. "Everyone's just pushing him to make a call so he can start retraining in time for next season. People want him to get back into it like nothing's happened." "I think he's trying to get back into it like nothing's happened," Nikki says. "Except we can't forget that it did happen. It's been almost 8 months, Aisha. You know how careful we've been with his recovery. You know how painful it's been. We wouldn't risk it if we weren't sure." "You can't be sure about anything with an injury like that," Aisha interjects, and Nikki pauses. "We'll never be 100% sure, no," he says. "But within the parameters that we have, it's as safe a bet as it's ever going to be. The healers all agree, and Joe wants to take that bet. You knew he would, if he was cleared." "Yes, but I thought you," Aisha says, and her voice is harsh. "You shouldn't let him." "I don't let him do anything," Nikki says. And for the first time, there's an edge to his voice. "He decides what he wants, and I support him, no matter what that decision is." "No, you just want him to play again," Aisha says, and her voice is bitter. "Of course I do," Nikki says, blunt. "But more importantly, it's what he wants. If circumstances change, we can reassess, but right now, it's a medically sanctioned option."
There's a short pause. Joe imagines them squaring off, two of the most competent and contrasting people he knows, both united and conflicting over their love for him. "Medically sanctioned," Aisha repeats slowly. And Joe braces himself at her tone. It's usually about now that Aisha makes people cry. But the cutting rebuttal doesn't come, or at least not how he expects it. "Nikki," she says. And to Joe's horror, it's her voice that wavers. "I know you know this. I know you must. But if anything happens again, anything remotely similar..." She takes a sharp breath, mug clinking against the counter. "The chances of death or unrecoverable injury are exponential now. Exponential. You understand that, don't you?" There's a long pause. Joe presses his knuckles against his mouth, fidgeting. His spine is cold. "How could I forget?" Nikki says, finally. And Joe's heart clenches. He gets through that reality through willful optimism. Nikki does not. "And you're willing to live with that," Aisha says. Her words are heavy with unspoken implication. "You'll support him with that too, no matter what." "Yes," Nikki says, without reserve or hesitation. "You know I will, Aisha." "You're both," she says, sounding furious again. But there's no real heat to it. Her emotions are about to crest like a wave before it breaks. Joe knows exactly how that feels. "You're both insane and obsessed and so fucking stupid, you know that?" "I know," Nikki says. And Aisha laughs like it's been shocked out of her, wet and choked and exasperated. When Joe finally comes into the kitchen, pretending to look none the wiser, Aisha is hugging Nikki like she's trying to smother him. And he's running a soothing hand down her back. "Hands off," Joe says, because he's actually a little teary himself and not at his comedic best. "Fuck off, you absolute fucking douche canoe," Aisha says, not moving. And Nikki smiles at him over her shoulder. Joe puts down his bags and wraps them both in a giant bear hug. It's a stretch, and Aisha makes a disgusted noise, but her hand finds Joe's on Nikki's back and squeezes. There's not much more they can say. Hey. The end of May heralds a hot summer, and Nikki finds Joe stretched out on the grass outside, hands shielding his face. His hair is back to normal now, and Nikki runs a gentle hand over it as he sits down next to him, cross-legged on the picnic blanket. Joe smiles at him in reply and catches his hand, pressing a kiss to Nikki's palm before resting it over his chest. Joe's heartbeat is slow and steady and strong. It's always been a calming thing for Nikki, but more so this year than ever. They sit in a silence for a little while, just listening to the trees, before Nikki asks quietly, "What are you thinking?" Joe's eyes remain closed, but he hums in acknowledgement. Nikki waits, tracing the lines of Joe's face with his eyes. Even now, even after being cooped up in the same house together for months, he never tires of looking at him. "My reflex tests came back," Joe says after a while, and Nikki pauses, fingers pressing into Joe's chest. "Analyzed over the last 2 months or so." "Mm-hmm," Nikki says, cautious. "They've been pretty good, haven't they?" "Mm," Joe says. His face is unnervingly clear, not stressed or angry or sad. Instead, Joe takes a deep, steady breath and says, "The results are good, but they're not as good as they used to be. They're not good enough." "You mean you're not continuously breaking your own record," Nikki says, trying to keep his tone light. "That's also just an age thing, old man." "Oh, is that what I am?" Joe says, slanting his eyes open to smile at Nikki. His tone is carefully light as well. "No, I know. I know it won't stay the same, but..." He closes his eyes again and breathes out. "It's worse than it should be. And it's holding steady now. They don't think it'll change much, even as I regain the rest of my abilities." Nikki knows that they are talking about seconds, milliseconds of difference here. and how important those tiny moments are for seekers. He knows that Joe's test results are still stellar by normal standards, except there's a reason why Joe is so renowned, and Nikki understands that better than anyone. Andy, Nikki says, and Joe nods. She knows. And we were always going to be training new seekers after last season. We got complacent not doing so earlier. He runs a hand over his beard. We might just have to speed that process up. You're still more than fit to play, Nikki says, and his voice isn't as steady as he'd like. As long as... Yes, Joe says. And his fingers skim over the side of his head, the side they'd cut into not so long ago in the grand scheme of things. His chest rises under Nikki's hand. Aisha's right, you know. Never tell her I said that, but... Yeah, she's right. Joel, Nikki says, and he puts his free hand around Joe's face, cradling his jaw. You know I meant it when I say, whatever you choose. I know, Joe says. His smile is warm, tinged now with sadness, but it's bittersweet. And as much as I want to take my miracles and just push on, push through, no matter what, he looks at Nikki and his eyes are shining. I don't want to put you through that again, or worse. I don't want you to have to go through it, Nikki says, and his voice is choked now. He feels deep in his bones what is coming, even if his conscious mind refuses to acknowledge it. Nicolo, Joe says, reaching for him, and Nikki leans down to meet him. They kiss like they can share the truth that way, without having to say a word. It bookends the moment. The final touch before Joe lays out his plans and changes the trajectory of their lives. Ti amo così tanto, Nikki whispers when they finally part, and Joe smiles at him like he's hearing it for the first time. There are tears on both their cheeks, but it doesn't matter. They are together. They both pause at the mouth of the tunnel. The pitch stretches out before them, perfectly still and silent, waiting for the infinite possibilities to fill its air. Joe has loved the sight of an open pitch since before he could fly. He tries to memorize it in perfect detail. The smell of the grass. The way the sunlight catches the goal hoops at either end. The way Nikki looks as he turns to Joe as he's done 1,000 times before. One last season, he says, and his voice is steady. One last season together. Joe nods, unable to speak. They walk out.